presentation. Just wanted to get you started.
Thank you. Well, thank you. I'm Ronald J. Dutton, better known as R.J. Dutton, and here I'm the director of the Office of Border Health at the Texas Department of State Health Services. And Allison Banneke, did you just push the enter here, or
is it click?
The only disclosure I have is that poor Dr. Banneke couldn't be here to present this. She's the principal author. She's about 8 months plus pregnant, and she's given me a few notes that she wanted me to be sure to include, and I will do that. Basically, I'm sure most of you know, the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System survey that occurs across the U.S., telephone survey, self-reported responses from people across the country. And in Texas this past year in 2007, the Office of Border Health supplemented that survey, oversampling the border. I think it was 9 counties, which represent the highest purport, the most population on the border. The Texas border, and as you can see in that slide, that the oversample included 4,527 border and 12,000 non-border. And statistical analysis, logistic regression in Sudan. Just to orient you all a little bit, the Office of Border Health has been operating in Texas about 15 years. There's offices of Border Health in Arizona, New Mexico, and California. And a whole lot of, geographically, politically important area for the states. And Texas, that region that you see there, is defined through an international agreement or a treaty between the United States and Mexico as the La Paz Agreement that defines the border as a 100-kilometer buffer. And there's 32 counties that touch that area, as you see in that slide. About 85% Hispanic, and El Paso dilutes that out, non-Hispanic whites was higher there, but Laredo, Texas, and Webb County is 99% Hispanic, for example, so very Hispanic region of the state. And I think that's about it for that. This country, and just one last comment, just to, I guess to give you, orient you a bit if you're not familiar with this. That Chihuahua, Coahuila, Nuevo León, and Tamaulipas, the 4 states to the south of this 1,000-mile border, which compromises half of the U.S.-Mexico border, which is about 2,000 miles long. There's about 300 million, depending on which year you look at, it's down a bit this last couple of years, legal northbound crossings that are recorded, okay? That's a pretty dynamic, and about half of those, by the way, probably a little over half of those pedestrians and people and cars passing into the United States occur in Texas, on the Texas-Mexico border. So it's a very dynamic border with a lot of interesting, it's a very interesting epidemiologic region defined by the sister cities that are on this border. So the logistic regression was for a vaccination status, yes or no, as the outcome variable, and several predictor variables, which I'll mention in a minute. Each vaccine, influenza, pneumococcal, hepatitis B, and tetanus, were analyzed separately, as well as combined analysis for age-recommended vaccines, influenza, pneumococcal, and tetanus. Let me see if the color's right. Okay, the variables depicted there in blue were included in all the logistic regression models. So it's very straightforward, I guess. It's a yes or no on vaccine and then breaking it out by these variables. Self-rating of general health and risk complications were included for influenza and pneumococcal. And for hepatitis B, the presence, and I guess that's in, it's hard to see, but in faint green there, for hepatitis B, the presence of one or more known risk factors was also included in addition to the rest of the variables. And, you know, one thing to mention that is that the BRFSS doesn't ask about all the medical conditions. So for the purposes of the present analysis, the individuals were considered to fall into a special risk group if they were reported as having one or more of the following, that you see there: diabetes, asthma, myocardial infarction, coronary heart disease. So, 31% of Texas respondents in the survey, ages, and this is an adult survey, ages 18 to 64, reported having had influenza vaccination within the past year. And the next line shows the variables that were statistically significant predictors of having influenza. So, as you might predict, or I mean assume, the higher immunization rates were associated with older age, non-Hispanic white compared to black. Black population along the border is very low. Higher educational attainment, recent physical checkup, being at risk of complications of influenza, and then I think importantly, living away from the border. So folks on the border are not getting their influenza shots or sprays to the extent they should. This is a graph that depicts that difference among 18 to 64-year-olds in Texas. The odds of being vaccinated against influenza are higher for the non-border than for the border, adjusting for the other variables in the model. So border residents were less likely to be immunized. For influenza immunization for those over 65 years old, much higher rate, 68% of respondents were immunized, said they were immunized, and that was associated against statistically significant rates for older, related to older age, related to non-Hispanic white, again, higher educational attainment, a recent checkup, and being at risk of complications. The border effect wasn't in play here for older folks. Pneumococcal immunizations among those 65 and older, again, pretty high rate, 65%. Higher immunization rates were associated, again, with some of the same older age, non-Hispanic white, females, higher educational attainment, recent checkups, risk of pneumonia and complications, and then being born in the United States compared to a country other than the U.S., and then also Mexico as a separate, where a lot of folks on the border, or a certain percentage of folks on the Texas border are born in Mexico. Then pneumococcal immunization among among people 65 years and older. So this is, again, just showing the differences between the prevalence of immunizations in the U.S., and Mexico, and in other countries as being statistically significantly different. Hepatitis B immunization, 37%, 18, again, this adult survey, so of people 18 years and older, higher immunization rates were associated with younger age, black compared to non-Hispanic white, higher educational attainment, again, recent routine checkup, and using English for the survey. Survey was offered in English or Spanish. Tetanus vaccine, ages 18 and older, 46% received the vaccine. Higher rates associated with younger age, non-Hispanic white, males, not females this time, higher educational attainment, recent routine physical checkup, living away from the border, wasn't a strong statistical relationship, but there was an indication that that was the case, and using Spanish for the survey. This is the just simply the schedule recommended 2007 adult immunization schedule based on age. So for all ages, all age recommended vaccinations, ages 19 and older. So, 38% indicated they had all the recommended vaccines. Higher vaccination rates were associated again with younger folks, non-Hispanic white males, higher educational attainment, recent checkup, and living away from the border. It's a graph that depicts that difference between the border and the non-border for having received all the recommended vaccinations. Well, very straightforward, I think, study that shows that some of the things that are expected, that a higher immunization rates among non-Hispanic whites than others and for those who had recent routine physical exams, lower immunization rates along the Texas border than non-border for influenza immunizations overall, and for overall age recommended vaccines, ages 19 and older, lower immunization rates among foreign-born Texas residents for pneumococcal vaccine, ages 65 and older. And just to indicate that this, because I think Dr. Banneke is our infectious disease epidemiologist in the office, she focused on this. This is not part of the BRFSS I normally see, but we have also a number of studies looking at obesity, childhood obesity, physical fitness, nutrition, other behavioral risk factor questions that are the core of the BRFSS. And that's Allison's email and mine. Should you want to reach her for some follow-up related to this specific study. Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am. Not exactly. And in fact, that's one big health promotion program that we've undertaken is to develop a binational recommendation card so that sometimes when people are flowing back and forth for they can sort of track their immunizations easier. Well, interesting thing about immunization coverage in general for Mexico is they do a lot better than we do.
A lot better,
yeah.
Everybody
can vaccinate somebody in Mexico. Now, it's pretty amazing that, see, because we always look at we're one of the poorest regions in the country on the Texas border. A lot of special needs that we want to address. But it's interesting that it's nice to have a shining example of a good public health program, you know, on their side, because we're always kind of pointing the finger at what's wrong, you know, how come we've got, you know, tuberculosis coming across, or how come we've got dengue fever pressing up, or hepatitis A. But in this case, they kind of show us how well they can vaccinate. They kind of deputize folks. They really vaccinate their kids. Now, how well they track them might be a question, but they don't have complete coverage, and they sort of lag behind generally. But oh yeah, I'm sorry, yeah. Well, that was my bias of thinking about what we do on the border. No, for adult, and in terms of binational BRFSS was considered as an interesting project with Mexico. The problem is you can't do it. You can't follow the same protocol. It simply can't be done with phone calls to people in Mexico. You could do it on cell phones, but hasn't ever been worked out.
There was a slide that you presented on that I'd like to go back and look at. And
Were you talking, which one was it? Was it influenza?
Yeah, that's it. So let's see. It looks like the non-Hispanic whites being on the border.
And I don't know if that wasn't statistically significant, I don't think, but there was a, I mean, it does look like the bar, you know, the confidence intervals are pretty big, but the other one was.
So what do you think is going on there? Are you capturing, it could be that Hispanics are not reporting as well on the phone, or their services are not, the population is going back and forth. I know you didn't probably break it up by who was migrating.
Yeah. No, that's a good question. It's always interesting when the non-Hispanic whites pop out. I noticed that there was one on someone presented on stress. The one indicator on BRFSS comes out stress. Non-Hispanic whites were dramatically different than Hispanics on the border. Non-Hispanic whites on the border, and they're a real minority, and I don't know why they're so stressed out. But that was. That's one. It's interesting though. By the way, geographically, there, like I said, El Paso is a city of nearly a million, and it has a high percentage of non-Hispanic whites, and so there's always you could look at things like that, like something unique to the non-Hispanic white group, but I don't know. Okay, thanks. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, what do you think is expected?
I think outstanding.
Right? Yeah, okay. Maybe they're lying.
No,
I always say that.
No, I'm making those observations based on national data, which I have in front of me right now, from the National Health Interview Survey to 2006. And your statistics, both for those, the border and non-border, is slightly higher. For example,
good.
It's broken out to 18 to 49. It's roughly 6%, and for pneumococcal vaccination. And for the 50 to 64-year-old age group, it's 18%. So if you put those two together, your estimate for 18 to 64 was higher than that. And then for the greater, for those who are 65 years of age and older, it's 57%. And then I looked at the influenza for Hispanics, and I found that your border and non-border was still high, because that was the lower was 20%.
So pneumococcal is almost as high as influenza.
Yeah, so we'd like to know what you're doing, one, and then
very
what
obedient
you plan,
people.
And what you plan to do better, because you mentioned something.
That's
about
a good thing, good to know. I mean, right.
As well. So we'd like to hear.
Yeah, I think our focus sometimes is, one of the big focuses we'll always have is disparities about the border versus non-border. But if something's working well on overall, it'd be interesting to know lost for a second because, that's the Texas rate overall or. What? See, how? Look, here's influenza immunization among ages 18 to 64. How come that number is. For Hispanics, it says.
It's 20 to 25.
Yeah, 20 to 25.
That's
higher.
Higher,
okay. Well, so things working good on the border in that respect, should have anticipated that. I'll get Allison when I get back. But that's a good question. And. Yeah, it's a good question.
When you talk about elderly people, they have never heard of it.
Right.
Of course, we run free clinics, but they want to go back and ask a private provider. Private providers don't give it. We have lots of outreach things.
Yeah. It might have something to do with the ratio that the community health services along, I mean, the community health centers have a high number of community health centers on the border. The access to health care on the Texas is the worst in the United States, right? Roughly 25% of Texans don't have health insurance. 40% of people on the border don't have access to health, do not have health insurance. 40%. They go across the border for some services, pharmaceutical, dental, medical, But there's a lot of primary health care services offered through community health centers and other sources. But it's just sort of interesting because we don't have it's not known as an access to health care, you know, area. And this represents about 10% of the Texas population that's dragging down the state overall.
Right.
Do, yeah, I mean, that angle of, I don't know all the details of that, but certainly the health department's very engaged in providing vaccine around the state, and I don't think private providers, well, I shouldn't say that. I was just thinking of one example, one Eagle Pass, which is one of our smaller border communities, 30,000. There's a community health center, there's a there's a hospital, community health center, and the health department. The three of them, I don't know what percent provide all the vaccines, but they're all major players. Did you have a quick question? Yes. Yeah, that's, you know, I saw one of... Yeah, you know what it's interesting you'd say that because I caught that note in here from her. She obviously knows... I just wanted to, the data for tetanus included any source of it. Yeah, right. They didn't try to discriminate that. It wasn't too difficult, I guess, for them to expect an answer on the phone.
I was just wondering about your proportion of vaccination to influenza pneumococcal disease. And I was wondering, because in this age group, it's based on people with high risk conditions that we recommend vaccinating, and maybe you have a higher proportion of those individuals on the border that might explain some of your slightly higher vaccination coverage. But clearly this is, this is suboptimal just based on the target population of high risk. If you use an average prevalence of the high risk conditions that are indicated for influenza vaccination. So there's room for improvement,
yeah.
And I was curious to know, you mentioned the binational health promotion effort.
Yeah, and that's children for sure. That's pretty much focused on those promotion, those campaigns, the vaccination campaigns are very much oriented on children. You know, I think there's been a lot of push for influenza vaccine. I've noticed, I would assume in many states, you know, in the last few years, you know, people concerned about pandemic. There's been a lot of that. And there's been a lot of, the border has had maybe a little bit, just proportionally more of it because there's been discussions about the international border and its and how dealing with that in a pandemic would be a major issue. But I just, you know, I don't know if that's it. I do know one thing. And you look at the, you know, it's a very young population on the border in terms of the Hispanic population, and it's an older population of the non-Hispanic whites. I think proportion, you know, when you look at it, you know, the age breakout compared to the state. But we haven't looked at, teased it out. This was, you know, pretty much a straight out, just ask that simple question without trying to tease out some of the influences in there.
So it's very helpful to see this information. It really is.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Oh yeah, yeah. And I'll tell you that I work very. My job, one of the major functions for the Office of Border Health, believe it or not, is to coordinate public health issues with Mexico. And I work with a number of the Secretaría de Salud officials on all kinds of things. So we're very much influenced by the Mexico and its programs.
Okay. Government pass a, to get a, this document, a guidelines document on mutual exchange of epidemiological information between the U.S. and Mexico. It's just dragged down over the years. I'm not sure 100% why. It's very hard, you know, there's a lot of political issues about exchanging your health information across the border. With bioterrorism issues, we've been, started this a program along both the Canadian and the U.S. border on infectious disease surveillance. We've got some weekly infectious disease, reportable disease information exchanges going on between Tamaulipas and Texas under the radar. And I'm so kind of, and we're very proud of it, but it's been going on for a solid year. Weekly exchanges, once they get approval for their data set, they share it with us and we share ours. If there was an outbreak, and you know, the recent Salmonella outbreak, St. Paul outbreak, will show you how testy things get. People really get worried about the impact you might have on tourism. So having free, open transparency would be, I guess, too much to ask. But we kind of just keep hoping we can get better and better exchanges to help us understand the epidemiology of the region.
Yeah, I know some of my colleagues have worked on the border, and one in particular, Dr. Waterman, that is assigned to the binational work. We have 10 more minutes, so you can ask any question you like. I actually have a question for Jim about the registry, and I know that you were looking at 11, adolescents primarily, but I was curious to know, and you might have mentioned this in previous presentations, about your registry, your immunization registry, whether people enroll in birth, and then you get additional information from the healthcare providers. Okay, what proportion of the state population do you think you're covering or capturing information? Because I know you have those zero dose denominators and you're projecting some kind of proportion out there. So I was curious to know at this time what proportion of the people that the registry targets, and that's children and adolescents now, is it adults too?
Well, there's a couple questions.
Okay.
Child and adolescent, and for the central area, we're close to, I think, by CDC guidelines, we have to be over 95% or something of coverage, and
that's wonderful.
There's a little bit of funny math going on, because we're looking at our census data, which is imperfect, and counting up kids in the registry in that area, but we think we've got really complete coverage for children and adolescents, especially in the central area, and it's pretty high elsewhere in the state. Now, in terms of adults, we've been collecting the information from adults all along, but we have a specific statute that allows the registry to run in Oregon, and that statute limited us to be able to share any of the data for anybody over 18 until a year or two ago, when we went back and worked with the legislature and the governor's office to change the law, and now we can share the information. We're phasing in the lifespan registry. So that's what we're shooting for, and so right now we're officially saying to people that we're starting. Moving up the age group to 23, and then we're going to expand. But in reality, if a health plan like Kaiser, who operates in the Portland area primarily, they send us everything, all ages.
Well, that's wonderful. And how long did it take you in the Sentinel area to get up to the 95% mark?
State and kind of the heartbeat of your providers, but Mm-hmm. And then anything else that child, their child population has acquired from other providers that we have is available to them via the web. We don't have bi-directional exchange, or online yet. Some of the other registries have mm-hmm. that, but we're actually testing that out with some large health plans, and I believe the Indian Health Service data set, RPMS data set, and we're buying a new software, big change for us, and that will allow us so they can, in real time, as a provider, get it, log in there, and get your shots in there, and then, pull up the record at the same time. It'll take us a while to get there, but it's going to be more functional.
That's wonderful. I'd like at this point to, we have additional time for questions. We have 4 minutes. But I want, before anyone leaves, I want to thank the presenters for these wonderful, insightful presentations. We learned about the impact of hepatitis B vaccination from a former student winner of the epidemiology section, and we're so glad to see her again, Dr. Wang Hung. And we learned about efforts to monitor very quickly introduction of new vaccines from Jim Gardino. And then we also learned about the vaccination coverage of our adult population along the border. So we are hearing the impact and challenges and opportunities. And thank you all for being here. And such dedicated public health professionals around immunization, and Perry Ann and her questions are always helpful, as well as our colleague from New York and others. So feel free, we have 3 more minutes left, and don't forget the closing session starts at 2:30, and it's with the Surgeon Generals, our former Surgeon Generals, and as you know, they were my bosses, and I'm in the uniform today, and I definitely will be there, and I hope to see all of you. So thank you all for staying to the very end and being a great audience. So the session is officially closed then.